You are listening to a pre-recorded episode of the Niptuck Talk Radio, brought to you by the Niptuck Coach. This is episode number 63, and we are talking with plastic surgeon Dr. Rod Rorick and author of Navigate Your Beauty on how to choose a plastic surgeon based on experience, expertise, and excellent results, and some of the myths surrounding plastic surgery procedures. Stay tuned.
Join cosmetic surgery Niptuck coach, beauty expert, and author of Safety First, A Consumer Guide to Cosmetic Surgery, Michelle Garber. Your host, Michelle's goal is to empower listeners and help them make safe cosmetic surgery procedure choices. This fun and lively show explores the world of beauty and cosmetic surgery and features expert guests on a variety of topics. No hype. Your host, Michelle Garber, is here today to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic surgery.
Hi, everyone. This is Michelle Garber, your host. If you don't know me, I'm the founder of Niptuck Coach, an independent cosmetic procedure consultancy, and I'm a patient advocate. My goal is to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic procedures by keeping you safe and well-informed so that not only do you get a great result, but you get the best result. To create more consumer awareness for safety and beauty, I've written a comprehensive guide called Safety First, the 10 Golden Rules for Safe Cosmetic Surgery, which you can download for free at my website, which is www.niptuckcoach.com. The world of aesthetics and plastic surgery is exploding. There are millions of people that are having procedures today. It's not just for the rich and famous as it used to be. And many of which end up needing revisions or worse. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't see an article online about some bad, either bad filler, bad plastic surgery, or death. So it's there's a lot going on, and with the advancement in beauty, there's also a lot of misinformation, myths, and confusion out there about all these procedures, whether they're surgical or non-surgical. And I'm honored to have with me today Dr. Ron Rorick, who is also author of Navigate Your Beauty and one of Dallas's top plastic surgeons. Good morning, or it's afternoon, right? It's afternoon
yes.
Where you are, Dr. Rorick.
Good
yes.
afternoon.
So. It is. Well, thank you for joining me. Dr. Ron Rorick is a Dallas plastic surgeon and professor of plastic surgery at the Department of Plastic Surgery at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Rorick is an international renowned expert in plastic surgery and has repeatedly been recognized as one of the best plastic surgeons in America. He's also been featured on The Oprah Winfrey Show, The View, Good Morning America. Dr. Rorick has a unique artistic skill in restoring youthfulness and definition to the human face and body. He recently published a breakthrough book for consumers called Navigate Your Beauty, Smart and Safe Plastic Surgery Solutions. Dr. Rorick's clinical practice is at Zale Lipschey University Hospital, UT Southwestern Medical Center, and the Tom Landry Sports Center and Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. I'm so happy you were able to join me to talk about all this, especially since your book did come out, Navigating Your Beauty. It's really in line with everything that's going on today, which is so confusing to the consumer. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions and myths that you frequently hear from your patients, starting with facelifts.
Okay.
What are some of the misconceptions that consumers have when they are coming to you for a consultation regarding facelifts or that you hear?
Well,
let's clear some of that up.
You know that you can do the one-day facelift or that fillers and Botox are like a facelift. You know, facelifts are real operations done by real board-certified plastic surgeons in real operating rooms, and they have a real recovery, you know, about 10 to 14 days if you want to get a long-lasting result.
So now when you're talking about facelifts by real board-certified plastic surgeons, let's expand that a little bit. What do you mean by that? You know, there's a lot of cosmetic surgeons that are doing facelifts. Mm-hmm. There's even dermatologists now that are doing
right.
facelifts.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, surgery is all about training, safety, and, you know, results. And so I think one of the things that the consumer needs to know is that, you know, are they a real surgeon, you know, and are they, for a facelift, there are two different types of surgeons that do facelifts. One is, you know, a board-certified plastic surgeon that's certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery, and then there's a facial plastic surgeon that's also, they're board-certified, but they're board-certified in otolaryngology. And these all operate, these surgeons operate above the head and neck area. So these are the types of surgeons that you should seek out to do your facelifts, and at least a starting point. You know, board certification just kind of gets you into the ballpark. Then you need to do your research on, you know, what are the three magic questions that you should ask anybody? You know, what are their top three surgeries they perform? Do they teach and speak about it? So that tells you about their expertise. And then can they show you long-term excellent results? So when I call them the three E's, you know, do you have the experience, do you have the expertise, and can you show exceptional results consistently? You know, so if you ask those three questions, it can really, really refine exactly who is in that field that's an expert that can do your procedure not only safely but also get a good outcome.
Now, what's your advice if you're a patient and you walk into the surgeon's office and you ask those three questions and then you want to see photographs and you look through the brag book and you see photographs that look pretty dated, that are maybe in black and white, or you can just tell that they're not current photographs. What advice would you give listeners about that? What questions would you ask the surgeon regarding that?
Well, I would ask them, you know, for newer photos, or ask them to go online, because often, you know, today everything's online, so you ask them to go to your website, and they should have, you know, recent photographs, at least, you know, three of the technique you're wanting to have done, and then sometimes even talk to patients. I don't mind if my patients ask, well, can I talk to a patient that's had a rhinoplasty or has had a facelift? And that's fine. You know, there's nothing like a peer-to-peer, obviously with the patient's permission, to allow them to do that. I think that's fine to do. And really, you know, you need to find out, is this something that you do all the time, at least once or twice a week, if you're really going to have the experience to do it? You know, you can't become an expert if you do this once or twice a year.
You mentioned speaking to patients. So I had this conversation with actually a local plastic surgeon here in the San Francisco Bay Area who told me that some of these patients that potential patients are contacting and calling as referrals actually are fake, and they've been paid to do this. Have you run up against that in Dallas? Have you heard of that before? And how can consumers weed that out? Because I was pretty shocked when I heard that.
Well,
I mean, well, not really shocked, but
no,
concerned
seen and heard
about that.
I don't think it's so common in Dallas, although I don't know. I'm sure patients call my office all the time. They're just, you know, not only doctor shopping, but maybe they're, you know, looking through some different venue. But I don't think it's that prevalent, at least to my knowledge, in Dallas. But, I mean, it can happen. I mean, I think we try and teach everybody, you know, treat everybody the same, you know, with a high quality of high touch and answer the questions they have. But there's only so much a person can answer until you see a patient. You know, I have a huge, you know, cosmetic surgery practice that's international. And so I can only, you know, I can talk to them on the phone. We can do interviews, you know, by video, by YouTube. But you can only do so much until I see the patient. So I don't really guarantee them hardly anything. I don't guarantee them anything, even when they're here. But I can't really fully tell them what I'm going to do until I see them face to face, because everybody's so different.
So let's go back for a minute. What I was referring to was actually people that pretend to be your patient.
Oh, that pretend to be my patient.
Right. This is what I heard from a plastic surgeon in the Bay Area, that When I asked him for patient referrals, like, how does he do that? He said, I don't give patient referrals because they sometimes, they can be fake.
Oh, I've not heard that.
Yeah, I said, really? You know, so there are people that are calling you up that want to be paid for pretending to be your patient?
I've never heard that. That's crazy.
No, that'd be like me soliciting you and saying, oh, you know, I'll be your fake patient for
in exchange
for some money or for some Botox or filler. And I was horrified.
Oh, my God. No, I've not heard that.
Yeah. Well,
but it's, you know, it's
apparently there's this big maze here of information. And I would hope that any ethical surgeon would not be wrapped up into paying for false information from patients that aren't really their patients. I mean, that's bad.
Well, I certainly hope not. I don't.
So going back a little bit to misconceptions too, because I work with a lot of clients that come to me, and mostly they've never done anything before. They've never had either Botox or fillers, and they're looking to improve their looks. And I think there's a misconception about facelifts and the aging process, how long they'll last. How do you approach it as a surgeon?
I think the great thing about, you know, plastic surgery is that you can treat the continuum of aging from age 30 to 80, because early on we know from the science of aging, and I've done research in this area, that one of the things that happens first is we lose fat on our face, you know, initially, especially in our central face and eyes and temples in our 30s and 40s. And that is treated by, that can be treated by fillers that are, you know, approved fillers in the United States, like the hyaluronic acid fillers, Voluma and Restylane and Juvederm. But as you age, you can only use the fillers so much. Once you've lost so much fat in your face and your skin starts sagging, you start having jowls, it's not possible for a filler to lift. It can fill, but it can't lift. So once, this is where people start looking strange and different, is that if you use a filler to both fill and lift, and if you have a jowl, then people look like, you know, a Stay Puft marshmallow, where they just look overdone or overfilled, and people don't like that look, and that's the L.A. windswept look you see all the time. That it's a combination of just overdone lips or cheeks, and you have to have an aesthetic eye of when to stop and say, okay, we've done all we can with fillers, now we need to move to, you know, a facial rejuvenation surgery where you're filling and lifting, so you're filling the central face and lifting. That is the, you know, the timetable for that is different. It's from, you know, it can be in the late 40s, early 50s, depending on your genetics. But you need to know when to put down the needle and pick up the knife to get the best, most natural result.
I love that. Put down the needle and pick up the knife. Ouch.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what you need.
That's,
and, you know,
great.
Unfortunately, you know, it's hard for people to say that. And because of many different factors. One is they don't recognize it because they don't understand the science of aging, or B, they just have only the needle. You know, if you only have the needle, the whole world is a filler, you know.
So you don't believe then that even fillers like Voluma can actually lift? They'll fill the volume?
They can volumize and lift a little bit, but I've never seen one take, you know, a true jowl away. They can give the illusion of lifting. I mean, and I love Voluma. Voluma is a deep filler. It fills. It can lift a little bit, but if you have true jowls around your mouth, it can't correct those. The mistake people make is when people have jowls and then they inject all around it, and then those people look, you know, like they've had, you know, too much to eat, or like a chipmunk that's storing, you know, their nuts for winter, and that doesn't look good. I mean, I can't tell you how many times a month I have to take out or melt away the fillers that have just been, you know, erroneously put there because they tried to, quote-unquote, correct the jowl. You can't correct the jowl by fillers alone.
I do see a lot of fillers being placed around the jawline to accentuate the jawline.
Yeah, that's fine.
And when there is jowls, to fill that gap between the jaw and the jowl. I see that done a lot.
Yeah, you can do that for early, you know, or if the jawline is not well distinct, you know, especially in the, you know, around the ear where it's not very distinct, you can build that up in that area. But I'm talking about a true jowl. If you have a jowl right by the chin and around the lips, you know, if you try and camouflage that, people look like, you know, they're storing nuts for winter. Not good. It's not a good look.
No. I agree.
I tell my patients all the time, and you know, and a lot of people don't want to have surgery, and that's fine. But you can only do so much. You know, we live on planet Earth, so which is gravity, and so you know, you have that gravitational pull, and that's just, you know, that along with loss of fat in your face, you know, really. You have to make the right diagnosis. If you make the right diagnosis, you have a very good chance of giving you the right result, whether it's fillers or Botox or fillers and surgery.
And how long do you predict facelifts can last?
Facelifts, in my experience, last about 10, 12 years. You know, that's about the time when I have to, you know, redo a facelift that I've done myself. Now, in the interim, there's maintenance of, you know, the cardinal things of sun avoidance, sunscreen, Retin-A, and then the use of Botox and fillers, you know, after, you know, a couple of years after your facelift. These are all things that will make a face look good longer, but, you know, in general, 10 to 12 years.
Now, doesn't it depend on how someone ages?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that also correspond to sun damage and how well they take care of their skin?
Exactly. This is genetically determined. I would say how you age is genetically determined 70-80% of the time, and then 20% is your environment. Now, there's extreme, you know, cases certainly like in Texas or California where people are in the sun all the time, and then, you know, there's been studies to show when identical twins live in two different environments, or one smokes, is out in the sun, has very bad skin, they can look 10 years older than their twin that's uses Retin-A, sun protection, doesn't smoke. There's definitely that aspect, but a lot of it is your genetics.
Now, there's a lot of new technologies that are on the market now, and there's a lot of new technologies that are coming on the market having to do with lifting and tightening, you know, whether it's radio frequency or ultrasound. What's your opinion about these?
Well, I think they're on a rotor pathway to the answer, but there is really no one good technique right now that truly has replaced or is in the process of replacing a true facial rejuvenation, a natural lift and fill facelift, as I've described. You know, I think we're getting there. I think technology like Ulthera, you know, ultrasound, where you're melting the fat and you're tightening the dermis, I think it works to a limited degree in some patients, but you have to choose patients very carefully. I think we're on the pathway for non-surgical rejuvenation in the future, but we're not there yet.
Do you do any of the non-surgical rejuvenation in your office?
Yeah, we do. You know, we do Ulthera in selected patients that have very minor neck laxity. I do it in all patients. In patients that aren't surgical candidates yet, or that have had, you know, surgery and that aren't candidates for revisional surgery, or that just have a minor, you know, problem.
So how does that work with patients that have had surgery and they need a little bit tightening to prolong their surgery longer? Have you seen great results?
No, not great results. I've seen a modest improvement. You know, the key with Ulthera is that you have to repeat it at 6 or 12 months to get a modest improvement. I mean, it's not something that is dramatic. You know, so you have to carefully select your patients very carefully. You know, it's at a limited number.
For those individuals that are don't want a facelift and have a little bit elasticity, and they're thinking about a non-surgical procedure like Ulthera, then they really need to make sure they do their homework, go to the proper facility to have it done, and make sure
and
that they're the right candidate.
Yeah. Right,
and be screened
exactly
to be
so.
A right candidate. Right,
right.
So don't jump into it just because it's the newest. You know, I think consumers have a misconception about anything that's new is better.
I know.
Than old. So the newest and the greatest is going to give me the best result. And I think that's a myth.
Right. I totally agree. You know, it's like the newest laser. You know, everybody will market the new laser and new technology until they find out where it really works, or most of the time when it doesn't work at all. And then they're on to the next laser. And, you know, the key is you have to be very careful to go to these doctors' offices that have bought lasers, because then it's financially driven that they got to pay off the laser or the technology, so they're going to push people to have it done. And I see that unfortunately, infrequently, just because I have that quote-unquote device, I got to use it to pay it off, and I think that's not the right reason to do it, you know, unfortunately. But I see it all the time. So, you know, luckily we do trials, you know, that give us the opportunity to look at what works and what doesn't work, you know, if you're in a university setting. But the key is, I would just don't be the first to do it and the last to give it up. You know, don't be the first one to say, oh, this is great, you know, because most of the time it's not.
You know, I see that a lot too. You know, you buy equipment's expensive. And if you've got several laser machines and you want to get the newest and the greatest, you got to promote it, because you have to pay for it. So,
right.
Yeah. So consumers have to really think about their choices and really evaluate before they make the decisions. And so we were talking a little bit about misconceptions and myths, and we talked a little bit about aging and facelifts, and I want to talk a little bit about Botox, because I'm surprised even when I see clients come to me that they still don't understand what Botox is. Or I once had someone say to me, oh, you had Botox in your lips? Because I had some filler in my lips and they were a little puffy, and she thought it was Botox in the lips. So there's still, even in 2015, there's still, Botox is still a little bit of a mystery drug to a lot of people. So what are the common myths about Botox, and what do you think of the future of topical Botox?
Well, I think that there's a lot of myths about Botox. People can, you know, misconstrue Botox with fillers. I mean, Botox softens and relaxes muscles and helps to lift the brows and soften wrinkles. And fillers fill. They volumize. They help to fill out the cheeks, soften some of the wrinkles. But they don't, you know, people have to have that explained often. And they're very good if done together, because you can increase the duration of a filler if you use Botox in that same area, like in the lips. You know, you can, if you put fillers in the lips and you soften the muscles around it a little bit very carefully, you can actually increase the longevity of the filler. But these all have to be done in the hands of somebody that's very experienced in the off-label use of these fillers, because, you know, without the experience and expertise, you know, fillers can really make people look weird and unusual, and that's what you often see in, you know, Hollywood type of actors and actresses, because they've really had things overdone or probably not done in the right places in the right volume. So, and then what about Botox in the future? I think there's so many new indications coming out for Botox, from, you know, helping to make your skin look better, potentially treat acne, even minimize hair loss, and now even treating mild depression, you know. So there's a lot of new indications coming up. Who knows? I mean, it's a very, you know, useful adjunct to a lot of different things, not just cosmetic surgery or making somebody look better. And then having said that, you know, Revance is a new topical Botox that actually is showing in promising trials to be, you know, as effective and fine in areas like correcting crow's feet. It's topically applied without a needle, and it may last as long or longer. But those studies are going to be done, or have been done, the preliminary studies have been done, and more studies are going to be done this year. So topical Botox may have a future, you know, in selected areas.
Let's talk about that for a moment. What exactly is topical Botox?
Well, it's a botulism toxin type A that actually has been formulated such that you can put it on as a cream or an ointment, you know, around the wrinkle, and then it gradually will soften it over time and can last several months. And I think some of the indications in the future may be for hyperhidrosis, you know, like rubbing it in your armpits to decrease sweating, and then also to decrease fine lines around the eyes. I think that may be one of its better known applications.
Now, this would be applied in the doctor's office, correct? It wouldn't be something that you would buy
right
and take
now,
home.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Because I could just see if people are buying it and taking it home, who knows what they're going to do with it. So it would have restrictions on it.
Okay, yes. And, of course, it's not even out of its clinical trials yet. So, you know, it's all still, you know, it's been in clinical trials for a couple of years.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah,
that sounds very interesting and exciting, because there are many people that are afraid of needles, and yet they would like to do something around their glabella or crow's feet, and they just have this fear about sticking a needle there, which I don't blame them. You know, the first time can be very scary, but after you do it once, it can be addicting. Fillers. You mentioned fillers a little bit, and there's a lot of different fillers that have come out in the market, and there's new fillers that are coming out in the market. Where do you see the future of fillers, and why is there all these different types of fillers for, you know, fine lines and for acne and for the perioral area and for the lips, and where they can all kind of be used in the same area, except, of course, Voluma, because it's deeper and it's thicker. But how do you see all these fillers in the market working together, and do we really need all these fillers?
Well, I don't think we need all these fillers. I think the great thing about the ones that are in the USA today that are FDA approved is that they've had a great proven record abroad and in Canada for many years. And I can talk about an example of that, Restylane Silk, in a little bit. So I think that the world of fillers is rapidly expanding, and it's actually very good, but it requires a lot more experience and expertise to use the right filler for the right area at the right time and the right volume, because a filler is not a filler is not a filler. Just because it's a hyaluronic acid filler doesn't mean it should be used everywhere. So I think that these new reversible hyaluronic acid fillers that are not permanent but longer lasting are good. They're safe. They've been shown to work in patients from 6 to 12 months, and I think it's good. But it just is going to require the field to not only expand rapidly but also to require a lot more expertise and specialized training. So I think it's a good thing. And for example, and I don't have any interest in any of these companies, like Restylane Silk, which is a newer filler that was just approved, that, you know, is specifically, you know, used for around, you know, the lip, because it's a smaller particle and it's softer, and you can use it to improve lip volume and decrease the lines in the lip, and if done well, it looks very natural. So there's all kinds of different new fillers that have different techniques and different uses.
Yeah, I actually had Restylane Silk, and it is very natural. I have to say that that in itself is different than some of the other fillers that I've had in my lips. It's very soft.
Right.
It's very velvety, like sexy, soft, natural feel to it. And it looks natural. It does not look like you've had filler in your lips,
no.
Which is something that that I really love. Now, I also, so I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about your book, which is Navigate Your Beauty. And I'm quoting your book. It says, "The single most important decision you'll make as you navigate your beauty is choosing the right surgeon. You are absolutely right. Choosing the right surgeon can be detrimental to you physically and psychologically."
Mm-hmm.
And I've had experience, so I personally know of this. But let's talk about this, choosing your right surgeon. When clients come to me, sometimes they come to me, they've seen three or four different surgeons, and they're still very confused, or they've gone to a surgeon that they thought they connected with, it was the right surgeon, and then afterwards they're unhappy, and they feel like they made a mistake. And so this is complicated. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy quest, and it's complicated to find the right surgeon. And so, what are some of the advice that you can give listeners on finding the right surgeon?
I think the most important thing is, you know, are they board certified in the area that you want to have surgery, i.e., board certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery. Which is one of the specialties that's certified by the American Board of Medical Specialties. And you can look it up, and you can ask them if they're board certified, because that then tells you immediately a couple of things, that they've had the proper training to be a plastic surgeon. At least that gets you into the ballpark. And then after that, go visit several that you've heard about from your community, from friends, and online, because, you know, the problem is, so many people think, though, just because it's on the internet, it's true. I mean, everybody's famous on their own website. Just remember that. And yet often you go in and you say, my God, that's not all like what the website said. And the other thing is, you know, you have to be compatible with them. You know, if you go in and, you know, while you're interviewing them, you should be interviewing, they are interviewing me. And that's what I always tell my patients, because I want to make sure I can help the patient, also that I can talk to them and that I like them. Because if I can't fulfill those criteria and I don't like the patient, or I don't think I can help them, I'm not going to operate on them. And the patient should feel the same way. And then after that, you should look at the three E's: their experience, their expertise, and can they show you exceptional results? And I think that will distinguish them from, you know, others that may want to have surgery. You know, if I want to have a rhinoplasty, I want to make sure that surgeon has the experience and does it once or twice a week at least. And that's an expert, and an expert's defined by your peers, not by how many ads you have or billboards you have in the city you live in. Do they teach other plastic surgeons? Have they written about it in peer-reviewed journals? You can find all that out fairly easily. And then can they show exceptional results, not only from their brag book, but online and you know, talking to other patients, you know. And so those things will get you, I would say, in the 95% range, at least, of getting you to the right surgeon. Doesn't guarantee you're going to get a good result, but that you'll be in the hands of somebody that's caring, competent, and can hopefully give you a good outcome. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. So what you're saying is, you suggest then, if you're looking for a plastic surgeon, that you actually ask the surgeon these questions.
Yes, absolutely.
And that you ask them how many surgeries do they do if you go there for rhinoplasty a week, and really dig a little bit deeper into the practice. Do you think that some surgeons, though, really get a little bit off put by that?
Well, I mean, they may. I mean, you know, the thing is, in areas, I think that, you know, if you want to find an expert now, do you need to have an expert if you're going to do a breast aug? Or I think you need to have somebody that, I think the most important thing is they have to have the experience and do breast augmentation, or do, you know, they have to have the experience to do the procedures that you're wanting to do. I don't think that's putting off anybody. I think you just have to be honest, don't you think? I mean,
No, I totally agree. I'm just asking you because I sometimes get the feeling from the people that I speak to that they're afraid to ask these questions for fear that the surgeon is going to feel a little bit like, well, I don't have to tell them the answers. There's this communication between the surgeon and the patient, and the patients are sometimes feel uncomfortable or they're afraid. Like, they want to ask these questions, they want to know them, but they feel uncomfortable or intimidated. Don't you find that happens?
Yeah, but if the patient feels that way, then they shouldn't have the surgery with that surgeon. Or, you know, I mean, I sometimes see patients that have, you know, they're fearful or intimidated, and I try and put them at ease because, you know, this is a long-lasting relationship you're going to have with these patients because, you know, if you're going to do a facelift or a rhinoplasty, you're going to follow them for a year or two and or longer, and, you know, you want to make sure that they're comfortable with you and that you're comfortable with them. I mean, this is not like a one-shot deal here.
Well, I think you said something really important. No, this is not like a one-shot deal. And you mentioned earlier that you're interviewing the patient, and the patient is interviewing you, and there's a likability factor. So what happens if you are patient's interviewing you, and you're interviewing the patient, and you're thinking to yourself, I don't know, I'm not sure that I want to work with this patient.
Well,
how do you handle that?
I tell
really?
Them that I'm not the surgeon that can help them.
And what if they say, but I really want you to be my surgeon, and I don't understand, and why are you telling me this?
Well, I just tell them that, you know, I'm very frank with them. I tell them, you know, and it happens not in, well, you know, maybe I would say that happens 3-4 times a year. I just tell them I can't give them the result that they want, or that I'm not the capable of giving them the result they want. And I'm just very honest with them. If somebody wants something done to their nose, which I think is not possible or does not look good on them, I'm not going to do it. And I'm going to tell them before surgery, not after surgery. I'm just being honest with them. I'm just
so this is more in respect to their expectations, or is this in a combination also of personality?
I think it's both. I think it's the personality and expectations. If I think that their personality won't mesh with mine, because, you know, you always have to think of best, worst-case scenario, then I just tell them I may not be the surgeon for them and they should seek others that are great in the area. You know, I think most normal patients will respect that. You know, and 'cause not everybody gets along with every patient, and I'd rather just make sure you find that out before surgery, not after surgery.
Well, that's very good advice. What are some other golden nuggets from your book that you'd like to talk about are important?
I think the other thing is, once you've selected a surgeon, then of course almost all of it falls into place. Like, you know, they're going to take good care of you, they'll operate in an accredited operating room, and that you have a surgical buddy or companion that'll be with you postoperatively. That's very important. Those are the things that I think are the gleaming aspects that you need to, you know, surgery is not for you yourself. You need to have somebody that's a surgical companion or partner, and many times that's not your spouse or significant other, unfortunately. Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not, and most of the time it's not.
So you recommend that they have a friend coming with them?
Yes. Right. We call it like their surgical companion. Absolutely. That comes with them to the consult and then is there for the post-op recovery. And, you know, and many of my patients do that. And those patients do so much better because they have somebody, A, that's they're a good friend of theirs, or B, that's had the surgery before, or that's, C, has been a patient of mine, you know.
Do you sometimes provide them with someone like if they don't have
some of my
anyone that they can?
Yes, I mean I have a service that if there are patients from around the country, which is about half of my patients, I provide them with somebody that can be with them and bring them back and forth from their hotel or their facility. Yes.
That's excellent. I don't know too many practices that actually do that, but I think that's extra support is so mm-hmm. important, because I agree, as you say, spouses are sometimes not the right person to have mm-hmm. with you after surgery and during surgery, because a lot of times spouses don't really get it. I haven't read all of your book, but I wondered if you had a section in there on how do you talk to your spouse about surgery, because I think that's really important.
Yeah, I do. I think that they have to play a very good supportive role, and they can't be the ones pushing it or the ones negating it. I think they need to be either neutral or say, listen, I'll do whatever, you know, I'm here for you. That's the ideal spouse. Many spouses, you know, are more neutral, and that's fine too, but I like to meet the spouses. I don't like to meet them on the day of surgery. I like to meet them before, if possible, especially if we're doing a rhinoplasty or face or, you know.
And do you sometimes have to hold the spouse's hand more than the patient's hand?
Sometimes I do, yes. Sometimes I do. That's why it's good to have their surgical companion there, because they're easier to understand. They get it. And fact of the matter is, most males are not as good at patients. They're not as patient, you know, and so if their spouse is a male, I mean, you know, we're not good patients. We're not very, we don't listen well. We don't, you know, our attention span's less, so.
Do you think one of the reasons why spouses are uncomfortable sometimes with the surgical process is that they're afraid?
Yeah, they're afraid of
They're afraid for their wives? That they're afraid
yes.
something is going to happen, especially with all these information online and everything
right.
you hear about in
yeah,
the news.
Yeah, and I don't blame them. And the goal is to try and hopefully, you know, keep them in abeyance. And actually, I think knowledge is power. Power of saying, these are the things we're going to do. These are the things we're not going to do. You know, I think those are all important. I think the more patient knows pre-op, the better it is. And, you know, and I think that that's why it's so important to have the patient empowered before surgery with everything, you know, that they know about. And so they're very, very comfortable, hopefully, on the day of surgery. I mean, they still have some anxiety, but they know what to expect.
I love that, empowered. That's exactly how they need to feel in order to get through this, because it's surgery, and you're not going to feel great right afterwards, and you do need that support. And I know that especially a lot of women with facelifts that aren't educated beforehand, they get really anxious about the healing, and because they see the faces swollen more on one side than the other side, and they don't understand. And some of this, again, goes back to the communication, I believe, between the surgeon and the patient, that the surgeon or the patient coordinator really explains to the patient what to mm-hmm. expect post-surgery.
No, I agree, and I think that the key is I explain this, we explain it, and then they get a handwritten sheet of everything and the instructions. Again, and then I always give them my cell number. They have my cell number. They can call me, text me afterwards. And it's kind of a comfort zone for them. And many times people don't read their instructions. And so the one or two texts will clarify it. And just so they know you're there for them, not only before, during, but after surgery, which is the most anxiety producing. And the key is that what you're seeing is normal. And that's all normal. I think that's very important. They need to know that their recourse is normal, if it is indeed normal. And they need to be told that, and they need to be available. You need to know they can reach out to you. I think that's the comfort zone.
This has been all very great information, and I want to let listeners know how they can purchase Navigate Your Beauty, because I think that it's an important book, and I think everyone should read it and really have an understanding of what they're doing before they do it. So I commend you that you've written this, because I think this is, it's huge.
Well, thank
so
you very much.
So important. And it's on Amazon, right?
It's on Amazon, and it's available, you know, Anytime. It is a great book.
Barnes & Noble.
It's very consumer-friendly. Yeah.
It is. It's very consumer-friendly. Is there a Kindle version yet?
There is a Kindle version. It's online. There's an ebook. It's all online. If you go to Amazon, you can get it, or you can go to navigateyourbeauty.com and pick it up there too.
That's great. Thank you so much,
well, you
Dr.
Bet.
Rorick.
You bet. It's my
and
pleasure.
And your website is drrorick.com.
Yeah.
And do you have a Twitter handle?
Dr. Rod Rorick. And I tweet quite a bit about just safety things and things people should know about plastic surgery and safety.
That's great. Well, we'll be sure to stay connected on Twitter. And again, I want to thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. It's been
a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to our show. If you've missed any episodes, they are available as podcasts on Blog Talk Radio or iTunes. You can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, or Pinterest at Nip Tuck Coach. And if you have any questions, my email is info@niptuckcoach. And remember, you only have one face and one body, so choose wisely. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you so much, Michael. That was great.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the Nip Tuck Coach Radio. Join us next week for another exciting program about the world of cosmetic surgery and beauty. To learn more about Michelle Garber, go to www.niptuckcoach.com. To consult with Michelle directly, call 415-494-7211.